This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of January, 2017, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, I'm joined by my guests, Zainia Wickett and Jeffrey Howard, to discuss the day's top stories. We'll look at charges of nepotism in the incoming Trump White House. We'll ask if Trump's Attorney General pick can dodge accusations of racism. We'll figure out how to write the perfect presidential farewell address. And later on, diplomatic faux pas from Russia to Taiwan. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Zainia Wickett, head of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both to the program. Another day and more controversy with Donald Trump's presidential transition. We'll talk in a moment about Trump's choice for Attorney General, who was grilled today at a Senate confirmation hearing. But first, another of his choices has been called out as blatant nepotism. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will serve as his senior advisor. Zainia, when we look at this, first of all, is this man a good advisor? Because actually there seems to be quite a lot of people saying he's got lots of experience, he knows how finance work, he's not just a son-in-law, you know, he has a reasonable track record in business. But is he a good person to pull in as an advisor?
So I think, I mean, let me say two things. I think a good advisor today means two things. One, that they have experience. Perhaps maybe means three things depending on their role. But as an advisor, one, that they have experience, and two, that they have the ear of the president-elect, soon to be president. There is no point in having an advisor who has lots of experience but does not have the ear. Or, for that matter, somebody who has the ear who has no experience. In the case of Jared Kushner, he's in his 30s. How much experience can he have? The answer is actually quite a lot. He has very strong biases. He has a very strong, what many would consider to be a very strong opinion on the Middle East peace process and the role of Israel, very supportive of Israel. He's supportive of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and that worries people. On the other hand, he does come with a lot of experience, and he very much has Donald Trump's ear. And so his background is actually he's more of a Democrat than he is a Republican. Apparently, he saw the light in the course of the election. So here's somebody who does appear to have an open mind, has seen a bit of the world, and very much is trusted by Donald Trump. I think that is mostly a good thing. That, however, does not answer the questions of whether this is nepotism. Of course it's nepotism. On the other hand, you know, he is the rules dictate that you cannot put into place a family member who is governing an institution. That is not what Jared Kushner is being asked to do. So and this isn't against the rules.
And it does seem, doesn't it, as though they think that they can dodge this, Jeffrey, because he's not being paid as well. So there's a few kind of like ways of sidestepping it. But does it matter in a way if you know, the closest advisor is somehow kind of even not by blood related to you? Because, you know, in many instances in the past, presidents have, you know, been advised by their wives very closely. And
Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. And that is, in a sense, you know, family nepotism, isn't it?
I think Zainia's absolutely right that this doesn't pose any particular legal problem precisely because Jared Kushner isn't going to be running any federal agency. The congressional statute against nepotism concerns principally cabinet secretaries, but it doesn't concern just political advisors. This actually came up, as you just suggested, when Hillary Clinton was on the healthcare task force in the White House because it was suggested through a lawsuit that maybe this ran afoul of the anti-nepotism statute. And while the court never resolved the case, it strongly suggested that the anti-nepotism statute just doesn't apply to White House advisors. So it doesn't raise a legal problem, but it probably does raise an ethical problem because the same reasons that would move us to pass such a statute might also move us to care about nepotism in these cases as well. And I think that there are probably a few reasons to worry about nepotism. One is about the lack of meritocracy that it implies, right? Would this guy be being seriously considered for a job like this were he not the son-in-law of the president-elect? That raises a further question about quality, right? Is he really the best person for this job? job. But I actually think there's a much deeper problem here that people haven't been talking about, and it has to do with accountability. What if Jared Kushner does something wrong? Yeah, what if he does something illegal? There's enormous pressure for Donald Trump to keep his mouth shut about that in a way he wouldn't be if he didn't have any familial allegiance to him. And I think that's the real concern.
And it doesn't actually even have to be something illegal. If Jared Kushner isn't doing a good job, is giving bad advice, who is really going to go to the president? He will then be the president and say, you know what, your son-in-law really, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You're just not going to do that because that is career limiting. And so it does change the nature of the debate you have around you. And I would argue that as president, in fact, in any leadership position, what you want is to be able to have an open debate with the smartest people in the room. Jared Kushner may be very smart. He may bring lots of things to the table. But by definition of who he is, he also brings some challenges to the table.
And Zainab, just looking at previous administrations, what has this role traditionally been? Has it been a role that you do literally advise on everything from economic policy through to foreign policy? What's the role of a senior advisor?
So there isn't really a tradition. It kind of depends on what people bring to the table. And what I think is really interesting, as it appears to be playing out in the Trump White House, is Donald Trump now has... Priebus as his chief of staff. He has Bannon as an advisor. He has Kushner as an advisor. He, of course, has all of his cabinet. He's almost certainly going to have Ivanka Trump, his daughter, as an advisor of some form or another, if not named de facto. You're going to have... I remember in the early days of the Obama administration, he brought on board an awful lot of really, really smart people, but he didn't define their roles and responsibilities terribly clearly. And what ended up happening is an incredibly... an environment of incredible backbiting and turf consciousness as people kind of said, this is my response, no, this is mine. And everybody was kind of warring with one another within the White House. And as a result, quite a few people left in the first 18 months. And I see that playing out here. Now, this is something that Donald Trump apparently quite enjoys. So he's setting up an environment where his advisors are all warring with one another, potentially. And that doesn't work so well in the White House, in my experience. So how that to me is the really interesting question that we're going to have to see how Donald Trump handles that.
And Jeffrey, just on that role of what the advisor does, I guess that to outsiders, especially people who are not traditional Trump supporters, you would hope that the advisor's role would be to somehow be a bridge between for example, the reality of what the intelligence services were telling you, or what military chiefs thought was acceptable and not acceptable, and what we know to be, a rather outspoken, mercurial, difficult to pin down president-elect. Do you think that he can do that job? Because it is interesting, he does have the ear, and maybe in that sense, he could be a better bridge than somebody who doesn't.
I think it remains to be seen whether he'll do a good job or not. I mean, the proof will be in the pudding. But I think the most important lesson to remember here is that just because you don't require Senate confirmation doesn't mean you're not a public servant, doesn't mean you're not accountable to the American people. And so what's going to be very important is that Jared Kushner view himself as a public servant, as serving the president so that he can serve the American people rather than, say, his family.
Well, we're going to turn now to that confirmation hearing of Jeff Sessions, who's hoping to be Donald Trump's attorney general. Today, the junior senator from Alabama defended himself against accusations of racism that have plagued him throughout his career. Before today's proceedings, protesters interrupted the event. Two demonstrators dressed as Ku Klux Klan members were escorted from the room. Back in 1986, Sessions was only the second nominee in half a century to be rejected for a federal judgeship due to racism accusations. Sessions' hearing will continue tomorrow. Zainab, likely that he will fly past?
Likely that he will fly past. I mean, generally speaking, senators tend to be kind to senators. He has to be approved by his Senate colleagues. It's very unlikely that, notwithstanding any new evidence that we haven't heard of before, and I think that's extremely unlikely, that he's going to find that his colleagues say no. So, I mean, I think he will fly past. Will he be a good attorney general? I think there are lots of reasons if you are part of the kind of liberal left. I think there are lots of reasons to be worried. But the reality is that Donald Trump isn't going to be presiding over a liberal left government. Donald Trump is going to be presiding over a Republican right government. And so whoever had been appointed into this position was going to be somebody that was going to be of great concern to the liberal left. It is somewhat worth thinking about how Jeff Sessions compares to Ashcroft, who I remember was the Attorney General of President Bush's, the younger first term, and hugely, hugely controversial, and did a number of controversial things while in office, but also did actually stand up for many of the constitutional rights that are part of what America is, including in his hospital bed, standing up for the rights of what America represents. So I think that this is one that he will get confirmed, and this is going to be one that we're going to have to see how he practices, whether he practices what he preaches.
And just quickly before I bring in Jeff, let's go back to the job descriptions again, just so we know what everyone's doing. You know, is his job to do what Trump wants?
No.
Or is his job to, you know, because there's
it's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
So the answer is, it depends on, I mean, it's all, you know, the definition of are you a representative or a delegate in some respects. I mean, it's very much tied up with the same kind of linguistic or real differences between those two things. I would argue that a cabinet member has two functions. One is to give advice to the president, and the other is to implement the policies of the president. So is he supposed to do what Donald Trump wants? Yes, in the end, we haven't elected a president. On the other hand, his job is also very much to give advice to the president, and in the case of the Attorney General in particular, to give the president's guidance on what is legal and what is not legal, what is acceptable by the Constitution and what isn't. In that sense, he may say some things that Donald Trump doesn't like.
Now, Jeffrey, one of the early questions for him today was, you know, on this question of should Muslims be banned from entering the United States? And he says, no, I don't believe that that is the right thing to do. I understand that the president-elect has said that it should be from countries where there is a risk of terrorism. We should have some checks and balances. And that's what I believe he wants from this. But I do not agree with Donald Trump on this. Is that a good sign already that he is not willing to go along with the more outlandish things that have been said during the campaign?
I mean, even on this point, Jeff Sessions is deviating from some of what he said during the campaign, where he was vociferous in his support of many of Donald Trump's policies, including this one. And it looks like he's changed his tune a bit on this, and now he's suggesting that he's opposed to this particular provision. I mean, Sessions is a mysterious guy in many respects. So he supports Guantanamo. He gave a passionate defense of Guantanamo during the hearings today. On the other hand, we heard that he was part of a very significant bipartisan bill with Democrats some years ago to reduce the extraordinary disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. And so on criminal justice issues is favorable to liberal ideas in some respects, although not on others. He's refused to let people who are currently in prison due to those disparity laws appeal for leniency. So he's a bit of a mixed picture. So I think it remains to be seen exactly what kind of attorney general he's going to be.
The only thing I wanted to add is it is really worth, we're spending a lot of our time kind of passing through what Donald Trump said in the, you know, primary campaign and what he said when he was racing against Hillary Clinton and what Jeff Sessions has said. I think we have to be very, very careful. Governing is extraordinarily different from running for presidency or running for a position. Jeff Sessions was saying an awful lot of things during the election that were incredibly supportive of Donald Trump. I don't expect him to necessarily believe those things today, to necessarily talk about those things in his hearings today, or necessarily to say that to Donald Trump when he's Attorney General. There is a division between those things, and we have to be very, very careful not to assume that everything that has been said over the last year is truth.
On the morning,
So empirically, I think that's absolutely
okay.
Right. So what they've said during the campaign makes no difference to what they might actually. Well, it makes it doesn't make.
Well, it should do.
Minimal
but.
Relation.
Well, this is it. It has empirically a minimal relation, but it should make a difference, right?
Yes.
And I think it's really, really important that we hold public officials to what they said during the campaign. And if they change their tune, if they suddenly start pursuing new policies, it's really important to get clear that their word is useless if that's what they're doing.
Now, the accusation that was made was that some years ago, he, for example, accused a white lawyer of letting down his race by defending a black man. And he apparently made some claims which he now says, you know, were misunderstood, or he didn't make that, that saying a campaign organization was also acting against white interests. Do you think that what he said, Jeffrey, in the past was racist?
I think that there's good reason to worry about Senator Sessions' record on this particular issue. So this was brought up when he was in front of the Senate for a federal judgeship, and the quote concerned a claim that a white lawyer, by representing black clients, was therefore betraying his race. And Senator Sessions admitted to having said such a thing, but was mystified about why he said it. And so I wasn't clear about what exactly went on there, but I think it at least raises a really, really important red flag. That said, I'm very reluctant to call people racists. I find it a very counterproductive way of engaging them. I think it's much more plausible to just criticize the particular policies they've supported.
Zainia, would you have any view on what he said then and his interpretation of it now?
I think that there is so much in the news that I am wary of. It's a bit like Jeff. I'm wary of coming down one side or the other. I think that there's an interesting... if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court, there are different Supreme Court justices interpret their job in different ways. Some of them say we have to hark back to the Constitution and keep to the Constitution absolutely in every word. Others say we have to interpret the Constitution in a way that is relevant for today's world. I think that the same is true of Jeff Sessions. It is worrying to me if he has a racist perspective. I care more about how he will implement the job of being Attorney General and how he will keep to the letter of the law as well as the sentiment of the law and of the U.S. Constitution. So thinking things is one thing, and what he does with that is an entirely different thing. Both of them are of concern, clearly, but I think we need to actually see how he goes about conducting himself as Attorney General.
We're going to move on, but can I just ask you one question? It's interesting. You know, what fascinates me is I think the liberals and the left just don't know how to deal with Trump and his team and what they're saying. And I'm not painting you into that corner of being one of those, but many of the critics of him are being super polite and very careful and measured in the things that they say about these appointees. So here we have a gentleman who's been accused of blatant racism, and who says he did say this thing. This is, and in many other countries, that would be a bar really to public office later on, especially in these times. You know, just cutting through to the thing that Meryl Streep said, which is may seem as a separate issue. But what was funny was that was one of the first times since the campaign that someone had said, "Let's look at Donald Trump and what he says in a very public arena," and she's been slammed for it because everyone has gone quiet on all these claims of, you know, misogyny, of, you know, grabbing women by the genitalia, of racism, of mocking the disabled. Are we all getting a little bit cautious because he is going to be president and we're perhaps some people a bit nervous of him, some people a bit nervous of, you know, hitting this august office? Are the liberals a bit scared to say you're a racist, you're bad, that's wrong?
So at least from where I sit, I can't talk about the liberals, but from where I sit, I would say two things. I would say that on the one hand, having a president-elect who is, and an attorney general, who is willing to say things that can be perceived to be, and are in many cases, either racist or misogynist or bigoted, it sends a message that is... absolutely extraordinarily horrible and is a reverse direction from that to which America wants to go. So very, very clear. Somebody who comes out with statements like this, that whether they are racist or whether they can be perceived to be racist statements, whether they are actions that are bigoted or misogynist or they can perceive to be, that I think sends an absolutely horrible message. On the other hand, we are at a moment right now where Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States, and the chances are that Jeff Sessions is going to be the attorney general. So what I want to separate that out to some extent from what are they actually going to do when in office. If Jeff Sessions follows through on the Constitution, on American values, on everything that America stands for, absolutely the kind of the letter and the sentiment of what America stands for, then okay. You know, language is one thing, it is awful. Action is another thing. It's also awful. Those two things need to be considered separately, I believe.
I think Zeynep is exactly right about that. I mean, the thing is that Donald Trump said a lot of things during the campaign that were fundamentally hostile to American values. But there was always a question about whether he actually believed what he was saying. And so there's an opportunity now, I think, in the minds of many, and I think this explains the reluctance of some to use the same harsh language today that they were using the campaign, they'd be able to get Trump on their side with some of these big policy
initiatives. It feels like we've entered this odd period where everyone is keeping shtum now. We're going to wait and see if he becomes president. And I wonder if, you know, for Americans, you know, that even Americans who hated him, it's because, you know, the role of president is something more in America than it maybe a prime minister is here. You know, it stands for something, and the respect for the president that goes with it, that people are just like now cautious about kind of saying, I don't like what you stand for.
Look at what President Obama did shortly after Donald Trump was elected. He sat down with him and he said, we have got to give, you know, all of our support to this man who is going to take a really, really tough job. I'm paraphrasing. President Obama said it far more eloquently than I just have. But essentially is, we actually have to support this man because this is a really tough job. And right now we have to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think a lot of people are giving him the benefit of the doubt and saying, okay, you've said an awful lot of things. A lot of those things are contradictory. So the reality is that your rhetoric affects how people see you, how people see us, how people see the United States. But that's rhetoric. Now we need to actually see what you do. And there's a chance that you could be not as bad as many think he will be. And then let's actually give him the benefit of the doubt until we see what comes to pass.
Of course, it is a puzzling thought that we should support the president and wish for him success no matter what. And the idea that, well, he's our president now, we want him to succeed. You never hear this in Britain. Well, we didn't vote for him, but she's our prime minister now and we all want her to succeed. Well, if you fundamentally oppose the policies on which she ran, then you surely don't want her to succeed. And so Eugene Robinson wrote a great piece in the Washington Post a couple weeks back where he said, I want President Trump to fail because President Trump said he'd support all these policies and I think these policies are morally abhorrent. And he was totally lambasted for that. But there's a question as to whether that's appropriate.
Well, we're going to take, I think, the shortest of short breaks now. You're listening to Midori House. I'm with Zeynep Wickett and Jeffrey Howard. After this, Obama's farewell speech.
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years, but don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
Welcome back. And still with me are Jeffrey Howard from University College London and Zeynep Wickett from Chatham House. Tonight in Chicago, Barack Obama will deliver his farewell address after 8 years as president. The speech is a tradition begun by the first holder of that office, George Washington, whose address has been deemed valuable enough for it to be read on the Senate floor each year. Washington warned against the dangers of partisanship. What would he make of 2016? Zeynep.
I think he'd be rather depressed, actually. I mean, you know, if you look at, there's a whole load of statistics that if you look at the level of partisanship in the United States over the last century, it has got steadily worse until about 4 years ago, the most liberal Republican still being to the right of the most conservative Democrat. The partisanship in the United States over the last 8 years has been truly horrendous and has really cost America and cost America's reputation, cost America the perception of America, the understanding of America, and cost America's ability to act in a number of cases. I don't see that changing. I don't see, you know, notwithstanding Donald Trump, the day after he had been elected, reaching across the aisle and saying, I want to be a president for all Americans. I don't see, given the nature of the election, I don't see Democrats being willing to what you were talking about earlier. I don't see Democrats being willing to cross the aisle. Democrats will be absolutely out to bring him down as soon as they possibly can. So I think American partisanship is here to stay. I do not think that just because the Republicans hold the Senate, the House and the presidency, that means that they can do whatever they want, because I think the Republican Party is not a unitary party anymore. I think this is going to be ugly.
Jeffrey, across Washington, desk drawers are being emptied, papers thrown away, pens put back in, pencil cases. Ambassadors who are Obama appointees are shipping their stuff back to the United States, getting the offices ready for new people to appear. What can Obama do with this speech? You know, as Zenia said, is this the point where he can at least leave a rallying cry to stay in people's hearts over what we said jokingly before the, well, not jokingly, before the program started? It could be an, you know, 8 years of Mr. Trump.
I think that Obama's speech will probably try to do two big things. The first will be to make a yet another plea for post-partisanship. I can almost guarantee that there'll be one of his favorite lines, which is that what unites us is bigger than what divides us. What makes us come together is bigger than what brings us apart. I guarantee you that he'll make some reference to the idea that we're all Americans and we're all in this together, whether we realize it or not. But second, perhaps somewhat in tension with the first, I think he's going to mount a defense. He's going to mount a defense of the Affordable Care Act. He's going to mention what will happen if the Affordable Care Act, that is to say Obamacare, the Obama health care law, is repealed. And I think in so doing, he's going to try to box Trump into a corner and suggest, look, if you repeal this law, millions and millions of people are going to lose their health insurance, and they're going to blame you, and they're going to punish you electorally for it. I think he's going to defend that. He's going to defend gay rights, and he's going to defend Cuba and possibly the Iran deal as well.
I love the list of things he's allowed to do over the next 10 days. He has the power to issue pardons to anyone except virtually any crime. He can welcome the incoming president. He can leave a note for the new president. I presume that's on the desk.
He will leave a note. Every president leaves a note for
do they leave it on the desk almost?
I don't know whether they leave it on the desk or whether it goes into a book or something, but yes, tradition has it that one president, and some of the notes, I mean, have been published, and or excerpts have been published, and are truly incredible.
Okay.
I mean, really worth. There was a note that went around. I think it was George Bush Sr.'s note to Clinton. I mean, really, just very heartfelt and inclusive.
And this was after Clinton had just beaten him in the election.
Exactly.
Right. So it's not like the stapler's in the third drawdown or anything like that. But and he's allowed to attend the inauguration, and he's allowed to leave on a helicopter. Do you think is that a tradition?
I suspect that they might have had enough helicopter rides to for that not to be the same kind of excitement. But trying to get out of Washington D.C. in a car on inauguration day is probably ugly.
Although last I heard, they're going to stay living in Washington, D.C., so their youngest girl can finish up high school.
Okay, good. Now, before we go, two diplomatic tales we thought we'd share. During an overnight stay in Houston this week, the president of Taiwan received a gift from the governor of Texas. It was a bit unfortunate. A clock. Greg Abbott seemingly didn't realize that this is the gravest insult in countries where Chinese is spoken. Giving a clock sounds very similar to a phrase used to say farewell to the dead. And then, does this matter?
It reminds me of the time that Gordon Brown and Barack Obama exchanged presents, and Gordon Brown gave Obama this wonderful ornamental pen holder made from the timbers of a Victorian slave ship, and Obama gave Brown 25 DVDs of old American movies. And you can just picture them having that conversation in the West Wing. Let's give him some DVDs.
But you know what? Let's face it. I mean, actually, the DVDs are probably more amusing, entertaining, were used by the family than, you know, the pen that you can't ever use because you're terrified of losing it.
And certainly not as insulting as giving a clock to a Mandarin speaker.
Exactly. Okay.
And then just lastly, perhaps not a faux pas, but certainly a case of a bit of diplomatic trolling almost. The Russian embassy in London in the UK has sent a message on social media to the UK Prime Minister, Theresa May, which included a cartoon frog that's become a famous mascot adopted by the American alt-right. What do you think they're hinting here? But you both look bemused.
It's mystifying. I mean, for a nation, Russia, that is so good at propaganda, that is so good at messaging, that is, you know, that has had an absolutely fantastic run of setting a narrative and getting that narrative sold to both the Russian people and beyond, I just don't get this. It goes over my head. I'm sorry.
But it just feels that these embassies, they feel like they should be doing something on social media. And there's probably some very junior person there who kind of, oh, this will be clever. And it's not.
I was going to say, what intern got control of the embassy Twitter account?
Yeah, yeah.
That's certainly what it looks like. The meeting is completely mystifying. I mean, the worry, I think, is that Theresa May will scupper the thaw to Russia that Trump seems to be pursuing. But it's not clear she will.
Well, Zanya Wickett and Jeffrey Howard, thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House. And that's all we have time for today's show. It was produced by Daniel Ciocapelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexis Sogi. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours is our design show section D. We'll have more of the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Thank you for listening and goodbye.